The 100 Years' War, the period between Poitiers and the Du Guesclin period. This part is known as the White Company period, which runs from 1357 to 1359. And today's show is simply the situation in 1359. I'm using the White Company as a term, and these are basically units of men that are looting, pillaging for their own purposes, but they will join the French side or the English side or various sides depending on the amount of money involved or the loot involved. So it's just kind of a general term for all of these freebooters, and we'll be looking at quite a few of the famous ones as we go through this. But frequently, it's just referred to as the Company period, 1357 to 1359. So let's see what the situation is at this point. Now, encouraged by the complaisance of the King of England and, of course, the disintegration of the French government, successive hordes of soldiers spread throughout the provinces of France, occupying castles, manors, and church towers, from which they subjected the districts around to a brutal military occupation before passing on to find fresh prey. Contemporaries looked upon these incursions as random catastrophes, the visitation of an angry god. Yet the movements of the companies followed a logical and more or less consistent geographical pattern. They spread outwards from two sources, the marches of Brittany and Normandy. The companies moved across the plains of the north. From Gascony, they penetrated up river valleys into the Massif Central, and from there to the provinces of the Rhone and the Saone. It was not until 1358 that the two streams mingled in the valley of the Loire. There's a pattern, too, in the regions which they left alone, the province of Poitou and the Santage, which had been exhausted in the wars of 1340s, escaped relatively lightly in the 1350s. I guess they're going to let them make some money before they come back and loot them again. Others, such as the principal seneschals of Languedoc and the Duchy of Burgundy, which had strong local institutions and well-developed systems of defense, succeeded in fighting off the invaders until the 1360s. Gascony, the territory of the victorious power and the home of most of the companies, actually enjoyed a brief golden peace. There were no major French operations there after the Count of Armagnac's raids in 1355. The last significant French garrison on the lower Garonne at Marmandy was captured at the end of 1359. The finances of the duchy steadily improved as the profits of the mints and the custom houses rose from the disastrous levels of the 1340s, and expenditure on war wages and garrisons fell. In the heartlands of the English duchy around Bordeaux and Bayonne, the government slowly reestablished its prestige as well as its authority. Edward III's officers attempted with some success to spread this Pax Anglicana beyond the traditional heartlands of the duchy into the disputed provinces of the March. In the valley of the Dordogne, around the Sauniac, where the provinces of Perigord, Limousin, and Quercy met, and the Bordeaux government was at the limits of its reach, the King of England's representative, Aile Pommier, established his own authority over much of the region and eased out the larger companies within a year of the Battle of Poitiers. Most of them were led by young men from prominent Gascon families whose worth was concentrated in the Bordelais and the Landes, and whose fathers and uncles were closely associated with the government of the duchy. They were vulnerable to official pressure. The eldest son of the Lord of Albert was brought out on Fons and its satellite garrisons in eastern Quercy by the local communities. Pierre de Montferrand, whose garrison at Bretel in the Viscounty of Turenne was one of the most dangerous in the regions. He sold out to the Vicomte in August of 1357 after only 5 months of occupation. The price was just 2,500 florins at a time when a well-defended castle in virgin territory could command 20,000. None of these places was reoccupied as far as it is known, and some may have actually been demolished. But there are other captains who are more obstinate. The captain of Nadillac, who preyed on the roads around the hill town of Gourdon, refused to go notwithstanding direct commands from Bordeaux and Westminster. In January of 1358, the seneschal of Gascony, Sir John Keverston, came up the Dordogne Valley with 2,000 men-at-arms, a train of cannon, and a safe conduct from the French conservators of the truce deal. In this corner of southwestern France, it is possible to follow the events in detail from the accounts, the minutes, and the newsletters which the towns recorded their trials and tribulations. But it's very likely that similar process was in train in Perigord and the Angenais as well. The sparseness of the evidence itself suggestive. War is better recorded than peace. The French retained important garrisons in both provinces, including those at Agen and the Bourg at Saint-Front at Perigord. But the lesser towns and the Plaise Plats were so far under English control that they had to be omitted from the summons of the Estates of Languedoc. So just think about that. When they called the Estates, the English controlled so much of Languedoc that a large number of the people weren't even asked to send representatives. Now, Languedoc, which bounded the English duchy on the southeast side, was the paradigm example of a successful, locally organized defense. The province comprised a tight political union of the three southern seneschalies of Toulouse, Carcassonne, and Beaucaire, which were loosely associated with the outlying dioceses of Rodez, Cahors, Albi, and Le Puy on their northern flank. In the middle of the 1340s, Henry of Lancaster's campaigns in the southwest made it necessary to put the defense of the Languedoc on more or less permanent war footing at a time when the government in Paris was preoccupied with the events of the north. Philip VI stopped trying to organize the defense of the Languedoc from Paris, and under the pressure of war, the region gradually grew apart from the rest of France. The critical development was the emergence of efficient local assemblies with extensive tax-raising powers. Some of these represented a single seneschalie. Some represented quite small districts. But the most important were the assemblies of the whole province, which met at frequent intervals under the auspices of the lieutenant or his deputies. The history of the Estates of Languedoc really begins with the Great Assembly in Toulouse in February of 1346, which was presided over by John II when he was the Duke of Normandy and the royal lieutenant in the southwest. From this time until the end of the wars in the second half of the 15th century, they met separately from those of the rest of France and developed on lines which were in some respects peculiar to themselves. In the first place, they generally represented only towns. The towns formed a political community of their own, disposing of much of the taxable wealth of the province. Linked by the habit of consultation, by firm local alliances, and by common fear for the security of their walls and trade, they were the financial strength and the organizing spirit of the defense. The nobility and the church, by comparison, played a more subdued role, generally confined to granting approval for the collection of the Plaise Plats of the taxes ordained by the towns. The Estates of Languedoc voted regular taxes for the defense of the region throughout the 1350s, which were collected and spent under the control of their own officers, so they weren't worried about the king stealing the money and using it for his own. They established a system of assessment by which the towns made themselves responsible for raising lump sums based on a conventional figure for the number of hearths or occasionally heads that were available. It was a great deal more productive than anything so far achieved in the more fragmented provinces of the north. The dominant figure in Languedoc remained John, the Count of Armagnac, a man profoundly sympathetic to these developments. Even after January 1358, when he was replaced as lieutenant by the ineffectual Count of Poitiers, he retained most of his influence over the affairs of the provinces. Armagnac deliberately encouraged the autonomy of the estates in order to free himself from the financial auditing departments of the government of Paris, which had crabbed and confined his predecessors. It was Armagnac's decision when John II was captured at the Battle of Poitiers to countermand the Dauphin's orders summoning representatives to attend the Estates General in Paris and to convene them at Toulouse instead. In the next 4 years, Languedoc conducted its affairs almost entirely independent of the Dauphin's government, organizing and financing its own defense, formulating its own foreign policy, and dealing directly with the captive king without reference to the views of his ministers in Paris. The province called itself Patrie. The natural instinct of men who spoke in another idiom, observed another law, and referred in their letters to Paris en France. So we've got an interesting situation here in that Languedoc has basically been able to become successful by doing its own thing. So it's quite interesting to see the change here. I will also point out that the Armagnacs are going to be very, very, very important. because it is the Armagnac forces that are the main army of France at the Battle of Agincourt. Now, the sources for this, the 100 Years' War by Perrois, the 100 Years' War by Nylands, and the 100 Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, ZumaHistorica.com or HistoryAccordingToBob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us as a patron. Thank you very much.